I don't usually drink coffee after bad news.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. Today is June 1st, 2015. Welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We are, just so we don't forget to say this later, we'll be having a public hearing on two bills today, Senate Bill 444 and Senate Bill 244. We had listed them as public hearing, possible work session, but we will be carrying over the work session parts of these to Wednesday. And I do want you to all keep Friday just in case there's any reason that we need to carry it over again, but hopefully we won't need to. And with that, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 444 and invite Senator Elizabeth Steiner-Hayward.
Thank you.
And also, Committee Administrator, could you please summarize the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 444 requires report on housing stabilization programs by July 1st, 2016 from Oregon Housing and Community Services in consultation with the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. This bill comes from the Senate with broad support. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner-Hayward, State Senator for District 17, and one of the chief sponsors of this bill. This bill stems from a bill that some of you will remember from the 2013 session, Senate Bill 450, which was developed the Task Force on Streamlining Delivery of Human Services, based on a concern that I have that while we are eager to get people to self-sufficiency, our systems are not set up in ways that actually promote people getting off of government assistance and back to what we know that they all strive for, which is true self-sufficiency. The task force had a broad membership. You can go back and look if you're so inclined. There's a great website that has all the materials of it and a lot of very robust hearings, meetings on a bunch of different topics. Ultimately, it came down to, it became pretty clear that there were three or four key barriers that were facing people who were struggling, and housing is one of those key barriers. We know that there's a lack of affordable housing in Oregon across the state. It's not just a metro area problem. We have this in Bend. We have it in even our most, we have it in Prineville. We have it, you know, all over the state. There's a lack of affordable housing. We also know that it's much more expensive to rehouse people than to keep them in their housing when they're undergoing temporary challenges that keep them from being able to pay their rent or their mortgage. And we need to be figuring out ways to focus primarily on housing stabilization, or at least put more of an emphasis on housing stabilization. When someone loses their place of residence and they're out couch surfing or in a shelter or living in a car or whatever their solution is, they face the expense of storing their goods. And then when they do try to get back in, well, they're out of a home, and that means that they're considered a bad risk, right? Even if they can find something that they can afford, then they have to pay first, last, and a security deposit, which is much more expensive than, and it's also likely that they're going to be further out away from the center of or the likelihood of where they work, and that's going to make it harder for them to commute to get to their place of employment, which will also impact their children. We also know that losing housing is very detrimental to families. It can also often result in families being split up so that they can all find a place to stay. It's considered an adverse childhood experience for our children, which makes them do much more poorly in school, much less likely to graduate on time, much more likely to interact with the criminal justice system. So for a whole host of reasons, having housing and community services start to focus more on housing stabilization than rehousing people is a smart thing to do from a human dignity perspective and an economic perspective. And Senate Bill 444 simply directs them to do that. The department is completely supportive of this. Partner organizations through which OHCS works, very interested in doing this, and we're just very excited to partner with them to figure out how to make sure that we focus more on housing stabilization, keep people where they are, better for everybody in the long term. Happy to take any questions. It's a pretty simple bill.
I have a basic question. How does it ask them to do it? It's a study? It's a plan?
Well, actually, the bill, and Ms. Johnson is right, that that does do that, but there is actually a direction that they start to focus more and they invest more in housing stabilization and come back and tell us more about it. Okay. So, yes, there is the report that Ms. Johnson mentioned originally. There is also direction that they start to work more on using their funds to focus on that. And Ms. Van Vliet, the director of the agency, is very interested in this and, in fact, has already begun some of these conversations. But we thought it important to put it in statute that the state sees this as a priority so that it isn't dependent on who's the director of the agency in any given moment. We think that this is the right focus, this is the right priority for the state to have when we think about housing people, and it's a sensible way to do it for a whole host of reasons.
Okay, great. Any other questions?
Were there, if I may, Madam Chair, were there any concerns that are holding over the work session, or it's just simply how you're structuring
things?
No, I just want to be able to address any concerns if there are any.
Exactly. I've heard no concerns. I've tried at every case, unless we run into a time crunch, to follow the philosophy of public hearing, let the public know, and then work at the next time.
Perfect.
Purely
That's fine.
For that.
I just wanted to be sure there weren't any concerns.
Philosophical reason that I've held on to as long as I can.
Works for me. Yeah. You're getting close to the end.
Yes, we are.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you. So next, Omar Carrillo Tinajero and Ryan Fisher.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Omar Carrillo Tinajero. I'm the Housing Policy Manager at Neighborhood Partnerships, a nonprofit that convenes the Oregon Housing Alliance, a coalition of members that include affordable nonprofit, affordable housing developers, nonprofit developers, residents, and service providers. We thank you for discussing the importance of housing stability and for the legislature's increased attention to the barriers that people in our communities are facing to getting permanent housing. We also like to thank the work group and the work that they've done and the discussions that arose around housing and the issues there. We're seeing historic difficulty placing folks in permanent housing. We're also seeing extended stay in shelters. We know that people are more successful in treatments, in school, in their workplace when they are in permanent housing as opposed to temporary or shelters. And so we support the direction that the department is taking and again, want to acknowledge that and thank the committee and the legislature for this. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is the statewide association of community action agencies. There are 18 of them, which serve all 36 counties in Oregon. There was a member on this recent work group, the Senate Bill 450 work group, from the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. Jackie Shad from Jackson County participated. She and the director of Housing and Community Services gave a presentation on housing that was part of this. And I feel that Senator Steiner Hayward has done an excellent job of really wrapping her hands around a very difficult and complicated issue. And this is a very good suggestion and a tangible solution that came out of that work group. We are in support of this approach, and we think it's appropriate that that Housing and Community Services is at the lead of it, because one of the things that we see in providing energy assistance to a lot of folks is that when energy gets cut off, when your power gets cut off, that often leads to an eviction, and we see how that triggers this this series of events that make it harder and harder and create more barriers. And the Housing and Community Services Department is also administering the energy efficiency programs within the state. So we think that it's the right idea and it's the right place to be doing it. And we're happy to be in support of it.
I guess they like the stability so much they adopted that as their new name for their new council. So, any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here to testify for this bill? No, with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 444 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 244. Robin, can we please have a summary?
Oh, certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 244 modifies and updates language for clarity regarding housing programs administered by Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, aligns eligibility criteria for Housing Development Guarantee Program and General Housing Account Program, directs State Housing Council to adopt policies to concentrate distribution of funds according to the greatest need for persons having low income and very low income. There is an amendment, a dash one amendment, that that in effect restores some language that was slated to be taken out, and it's very minor language talking about adopting a rule. So it really doesn't change. It just leaves some language in, and I believe that Ms. Van Bleet will speak to the amendment. And again, this bill comes to us from the Senate with unanimous support. There is no revenue impact and it has a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, Ms. Van Bleet.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. Margaret Van Bleet, Housing and Community Services Director. Senate Bill 244 is, as the committee administrator said, a fairly straightforward and simple program change bill. It will allow us to align our eligibility criteria for two multifamily programs that we've long administered. One is the Housing Development Guarantee Program, and the other is the General Housing Account Program. Very descriptive names. This change comes out of the transition work you've been hearing about. Our stakeholders and the deep kind of analytical process pointed us to a number of things that we could do to streamline program delivery. Most of that we're accomplishing through rule writing and through sort of program guidelines and administration, but there are a couple of things that show up in statute that make it confusing to use these two programs sort of interchangeably. And so we wanted to align them. And so that's in essence what this bill does. As you've heard, it passed the Senate 30-0. The dash one amendment, I think, serves to strengthen our emphasis on geographic equity in ways that this committee has talked about. And so for that reason, we thought it was important to really underscore and keep that in the statute in the way we've been talking about. And the only other thing I would note for the committee is that, to the best of my knowledge, our partners and stakeholders are all very supportive of this. It hasn't raised concerns that I'm aware of, and so I think it's a fairly straightforward bill. Be happy to answer questions if folks have them.
Could you say something else about the dash one amendment and how it relates to geographic?
Yes, and so it's at the end of the draft bill, the bolded language talks about adopting a policy that provides for distribution while concentrating account monies and investment revenue in those areas of the state with the greatest need, as determined by the Housing Stability Council. So it comes back to that idea that when we're making decisions about how to distribute these scarce resources, we do so with an eye towards the areas throughout the state with the greatest need. And as you know, the Housing Stability Council's new statutes do speak about the kinds of things that we should look at in determining need.
Okay, any questions? All right.
Okay.
Thank you. Good work.
Thank you.
Skipping along. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 244? All right. Close the public hearing on 244, and I'll open an informational hearing on an update of the 2013 House Bill 2639, Section 8 Housing Choice. And I call up John Van Landingham, Jill Smith, Todd Johnston, and Jim Straub.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid. We have a set presentation, the four of us, and we have topics which we hope to cover accurately. I would encourage you to refrain on questions until all four of us are done, because you may get the answer, or you may not. So I'm doing the leadoff. Oregon law, ORS 659A421, is the state's housing discrimination statute. What it says is that the sellers or renters of real property cannot discriminate in selling or renting that property on the basis of the protected classes that you've all heard about before: race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, marital status, familial status, or source of income. Source of income covers things like Social Security benefits, welfare benefits. It does not include things such as income from illegal activities, selling drugs, or income from certain professions, such as being a lawyer. But it expressly excluded Section 8 benefits before 2639 in 2013. So, prior to that bill passing in 2013, landlords were expressly authorized to discriminate against applicants because they used a Section 8 voucher. That was the point of the bill. It was not uncommon, prior to the effective date of the bill, to see advertisements saying no Section 8. You're going to hear more about what exactly Section 8 means, but it is the primary rent assistance program in this country. 2639 in 2013 removed that exclusion. That bill passed after a big investigation by the Oregonian, a big series by the Oregonian, showing that Section 8 vouchers were, their use was being clustered in East Multnomah County and Gresham, because landlords in other parts of the Portland metro area were not accepting those vouchers. The point of the program, as created by Congress some years ago, was to allow the voucher holders, and there are housing authorities serving every county in this state, every county in the country. They are the primary mechanism for delivering rental housing assistance in the country. I can't remember where I was with that. Can't remember what I was saying. Sorry, I've lost my track. No. So the Oregonian did this story showing that the vouchers were being concentrated in their use. One of the purposes of the program was to avoid that kind of concentration. The idea was to allow the voucher holders to use their own initiative to find a place that was safe to live, a safe neighborhood, close to employment, close to good schools. And because of the fact that the voucher use was being clustered, you were defeating the purpose of the program. They were all ending up in one part of the community. And a lot of people were unable to use their vouchers because federal law said you had to use the voucher to find a place to rent within a certain period of time, and if you failed, you gave it back. Giving it back might meant that you had to get back at the end of the waiting list. The waiting list is multi-years long, depending on that particular community. As a result of the Oregonian series, Speaker Kotek convened a work group, and we three were part of that work group, along with other representatives of the housing authorities, the landlords, and the tenants. Landlords have some legitimate concerns about renting to Section 8 tenants, and we discussed those in that work group. The bill attempts to address a number of those concerns. In particular, it creates the Landlord Guarantee Fund, which is basically functions as a $5,000 security deposit for any landlord who rents to a Section 8 tenant. And we've made it fairly simple administratively, but also for landlords to submit a claim to get reimbursed from that. The report, you have an electronic copy of the report that the department has prepared. It shows that I think 7 claims have been approved since the program became effective in July of 2014. It's about $31,000. It's not a huge amount of money. Knock on wood, it won't grow. But it's significant to landlords, and Jim Straub will talk about the significance of that. Other things that we did in the bill to address landlords' concerns were, one, to make it clear that even though we're saying you can't discriminate against somebody based on source of income, you can discriminate against lawfully against people because of their conduct. So if they have a history of bad conduct, you don't have to rent to them. We've also said that you can discriminate against them based on their inability to pay rent. If with the voucher they can't pay your rent, you don't have to rent to them. You are not required to lower your rent to make the unit eligible for Section 8 property. There are other concerns that landlords have, and I don't know whether Jim's going to talk about those, but the bill requires the creation of a Housing Choice Advisory Committee, and we four are members of that committee. It's been meeting monthly for about 9 months, and one of the tasks for that committee is to determine how well we're doing with this. Is it working? Are there problems? Are there things that we can do better? For example, can we help housing authorities understand what landlords' concerns are and address those concerns? I think we're making progress with that. And you'll hear a lot more about that from the other panelists. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. I'm Jill Smith. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Home Forward, the housing authority that serves Multnomah County. I wanted to tell you a little bit about what the Housing Choice Voucher Program is, and we were hoping to start that off by showing this short video. Is that cute?
Okay. Just realized we didn't do the video.
Fair housing means that everyone can find a place to live. Things like race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation can't be used to reject a person's application to rent. Families also can't be excluded based on their source of income. But in Oregon, until recently, it was still legal for landlords to reject families that use housing assistance, like Section 8 vouchers. Section 8 is a federal housing program started in the 1970s to help low-income people, the elderly, and people with special needs find clean and safe housing. Families are screened for income and must pass a background check to be eligible. If accepted into the program, a family typically contributes around 30% of their household income to the rent. The voucher covers the rest. But because landlords were allowed to reject families solely because they use housing assistance, these families often had little choice in where they could live. That changed in July of 2014 when the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2639, which closed this loophole. It is now illegal in Oregon to discriminate against potential renters solely because they use housing assistance. The law also prevents policies that exclude these renters, even if they don't say so explicitly. Violations are punishable by fines or subject to damages in court actions. For the tens of thousands of Oregon families who use Section 8 and other forms of housing assistance, the new law means they can live closer to their jobs, public transportation, and schools. The new law also better protects landlords. If a tenant using housing assistance leaves while still owing money, a landlord can sue in small claims court. If successful, rather than having to wait on the tenant to come up with the money, the landlord will receive compensation from the Oregon Department of Housing and Community Services. This means landlords can feel more secure in renting to families who use housing assistance. And those families now have more choice when looking for a place to call home. For more information, go to OregonLawHelp.org/find-legal-help.
That little clip is part of an educational program that many of us here are participating in that goes across the state, and I'll tell you just a bit more about it in a minute. There are 22 public housing authorities that are located throughout the state of Oregon, and each agency has a local governance structure and must adhere to federal regulations and federal law. Public housing authorities represent every county in the state. And the Housing Choice Voucher Program that we're talking about today is commonly referred to, especially in Oregon, as Section 8. For your information, there are almost 35,000 vouchers in the state of Oregon, and approximately $200 million in federal funding flows into this state via that program and out to local market landlords to support very low-income households in our state. The program serves households that have to earn, due to federal regulation and requirements, less than 50% of area median income. The average annual income for a voucher holder in the state of Oregon is approximately $12,000. About 60% of the voucher holders are disabled and elderly households receiving Social Security in the state. The Housing Choice Voucher Program, as you probably know, is the largest rent assistance program in the state and the country, and it's very popular because it offers choice to people. People can choose to live where they want to live. At least we hope so. That was the purpose behind this bill. They can choose to live close to transportation if they need it, near family for support, near childcare, near the potential for education or work. And I had them hand this out to you, this triangle, because this, along with that video, really gives you a good idea of how the Section 8 program works in a really simple format. There's three legal binding documents that make this program work. At the top point is the voucher participant and the landlord's tenant. A legal binding lease ties that tenant to the landlord with the same requirements and restrictions as any other market tenant. A voucher with associated rules called family obligations tie the participant to the housing authority that has to administer federal regulations to ensure the participant remains eligible for the program. Most of those link to abiding by the terms of the lease. And then the housing authority, this should say housing authority, I apologize, it says home forward. The housing authority is linked to the landlord with what's called a housing assistance payment contract, which means they have to pay their portion of the rent as long as that family resides in the unit. And basically, it's really important, it's critical that all three parties cooperate, talk, communicate, and work together to make this program happen. And while we do have about $200 million a year coming into the state in rent assistance, we don't have that many rental units without our private market landlords willing to participate. There has been huge amounts of training going on throughout the state, and I wanted to highlight one of those efforts. The focus has been on the bill and the expansion of fair housing, making sure that landlords and housing authorities know their new obligations that are associated with the bill. Meyer Memorial Trust has granted has provided funds for a grant for the Housing Choice Education Partnership, and it's all of the Oregon Housing Authorities, the Oregon Law Center, and Multifamily Northwest, and there's five statewide trainings that are going on. We've had three more scheduled throughout the state. They've been sold out, very well attended, great questions answered. Housing authorities are getting trained on how to improve their customer service. They're leaving with tools in hand to make them better at working with landlords and the low-income people we serve. We're excited about the training. We're hoping to see continued improvements. And one thing that I wanted to really express is not only has this bill added some protections for very low-income people, but it's offered the real opportunity for landlords and people that represent low-income people and housing authorities to talk. Unlike never before, relationships have been built and units have been made available that weren't available before. I know at Home Forward, we have almost 200 new landlords that have never worked with us before in the last 9 months. And that's even in a very tight rental market. And that's the last thing I wanted to touch on quickly is, unfortunately, we have this amazing deal with a state-backed landlord guarantee fund, and we have the tightest rental market we've ever had in ever, and across the country, I think it's the tightest at the same time, making it challenging to really test it and push it and see if we can be successful. I'm sure that you all know that in Bend, vacancy rates are less than 0.5%, and there's some parts of Multnomah County that they're 1%. So unfortunately, a number of the voucher holders, when they get a voucher in their hand, they're unsuccessful at finding a unit. Right now in Multnomah County, only about 75% of the people who have a voucher are being successful. I don't know that we've been that low in over 10 years. So we need the units, the hard units of affordable housing, in addition to what we already have. Another important point that you should be aware of is HUD funds all of that money that comes to housing authorities to help our low-income households based on our utilization levels at housing authorities. So what we spend this year, if it's under what we're authorized, unfortunately, that's what they'll give us next year. So it's critical that we spend these funds that come into our state.
Tom? Okay. Well, thank you, Jill. So good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Todd Johnston, and I'm the executive director for Northwest Oregon Housing Authority, which serves Columbia, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. I'm also here representing the Oregon Housing Authorities Association, 22 housing authorities across the state. I currently serve as the president, and I just want to give an update that, not an update, I guess, but thank you. I just wanted to say that the housing authorities have been very supportive of this bill, and I've worked with the different stakeholders mainly to, I guess, educate people about the Section 8 program and what it does, what it does not do, and how it works. So I think that's been a very important component for the housing authorities in working with this bill and the different stakeholders has been the education part of it. I wanted to point out also that for rural housing authorities like us, it has been a very tight rental market due to lack of vacancies or lack of units in general in the rural areas. So I think this has also helped to put a foot in the door for voucher holders in the rural areas because more landlords are open to and wanting to educate themselves about the program, which gives more choice for the voucher holders in the rural communities where the housing has been scarce to begin with. Our waiting list runs 2 to 3 years. We're a small jurisdiction. The other larger jurisdictions are longer. So as Jill mentioned, if someone does not get housed, they have to go back to the end of that waiting list and go through the process again. Another point I wanted to bring out that we felt was very successful with the bill is that we have VASH vouchers, which are Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing Vouchers, which provide supportive services and housing assistance to veterans. Those are also Section 8 vouchers, so this bill has been very successful in the state's effort to house homeless veterans. So we feel like that has been a key point that has come out of this bill. And also, I guess, just to follow up on what Jill said, the rental market has definitely had an impact on the implementation of the bill. But overall, statewide, throughout all the 22 housing authorities, we have seen similar percentage-wise numbers, as Jill mentioned, as far as new landlords and people wanting to participate in the program. Even in our rural area, we are doing an education outreach program, and we've seen a lot of new interest in that, which is very positive, I think, for our renters. So that was all I had to add, unless there's any other questions, and I'll turn it over to Jim Straub.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Straub. I'm a landlord, a member of the Housing Choice Advisory Committee, and also a legislative director of the Oregon Rental Housing Association. We have 13 chapters scattered throughout the state of Oregon. In this role, I was intimately involved in the negotiations surrounding the passage of the Housing Choice Act of 2013. Originally, landlords were opposed to this bill as it was then written, but through numerous meetings with Speaker Kotek and staff, we were ultimately able to come up with a solution that we felt benefited all the stakeholders. The cornerstone of the landlord's support of this bill, then and now, resides in the Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Fund. It's a mitigation fund which helps alleviate concerns from small business owner landlords that they will be able to collect for and or repair damages from tenants with minimal income and assets. Landlords felt that renting to tenants with minimal income and assets requires a great business risk. When we expressed this concern to Speaker Kotek, working together, we were able to develop this mitigation fund, which helps protect the interest of landlords too. The legislators involved in the passage of this bill recognized our concerns, and the landlord community felt valued and heard. Because of the mitigation fund, landlords are now advocates of the program. The market is changing as awareness grows about the program. We continue to reach new landlords on a daily basis through education and outreach. Through their work with the Housing Choice Advisory Committee, public housing authorities have made a tremendous effort to work with landlords to change policies and procedures during their implementation of program requirements, which makes it easier for landlords to participate in the program, and I thank them for that. The Housing Choice Advisory Committee continues to move forward in several ways, including monitoring efforts by public housing authorities to seek federal waivers for some of the requirements around inspections and other regulations associated with the Housing Choice Voucher Program, monitoring the Landlord Guarantee Fund and claims made, making sure that it's not abused, seeking ways to improve relationships between landlords and housing authority staff, monitoring education for landlords, housing authorities, and tenants, and understanding market conditions and their impact on Housing Choice voucher holders and landlords. I believe the Housing Choice Act of 2013 is an excellent example of how various stakeholders came together to help make good law. I'm pleased and proud to be a part of this process. Thank you. Any questions?
I have several, but would any members like to ask first?
No. Would you go first?
Well, first of all, thank you for all of your work on this. I was a member of this committee in 2013, and so heard a lot then about the progress and the collaboration that you did to come together, and I think the Mitigation Fund is a huge piece of that. I think really brilliant, and the idea behind it was just that if you're running out to low-income people, they may not have the funds if there's property damage or anything like that. So I thought it was a great step forward. I'm curious about, and I know you have a big, long report here, if you could just summarize how many more units have come on the market, if there have been more. You keep talking about education, so it sounds like maybe this program is still very fledgling and you're still getting the word out, and maybe there have not been a lot more units that have come on the market. So could you talk about the impact been in terms of availability of rental?
Participating?
I'll briefly touch on it, and then Jill can follow up. From a landlord's perspective, you know, it's basic economic supply and demand. Increased demand, and the supply will follow a little slowly. But our focus on education is letting landlords know, number one, that it's the law now and you can't discriminate against it. But number two, to actually show them the benefits of the program, the mitigation fund, of course, being key, and encouraging them to seek the program out and to actually, instead of having ads that say no Section 8, Section 8 welcome. I mean, from a business perspective, having a $5,000 mitigation fund is huge. Where else can a landlord get a $5,000+ security deposit? I've joked about it that you may see advertisement in the future that says Section 8 only. I mean, it's a huge win. It takes a while for that pendulum to swing, for people, for landlords to recognize the benefits of the program. Most of the landlords in the state are non-professionals, or what we call mom and pops. They don't follow the news as closely on this topic as professionals in the industry. They don't follow the laws as much. When they have a turnover, they usually just collect the rents and when they come in, but if they have a turnover, that's when they'll educate themselves on the new laws, and a lot of tenants will stay 2, 3, 4 years. So I think over a couple of years, you'll see a big title shift of new landlords actually seeking the market out.
Yeah, actually, this is a market-driven program, so it's hard for us to measure new units. We can measure new landlords that have never participated before. One of the pros of this program is it's market-driven because people get to be scattered throughout the private market, and they like that. That's also a con. When the market is this tight and there's so few available units, it's tougher for people to be successful if you don't have a lot of extra money for deposits and application fees. So in Oregon, all of our housing authorities are high performers. They're using all of their vouchers. The tight rental market is not helping us, but this bill definitely is helping us. So we're all using, you know, close to 100% of all of our vouchers, but we're having to work really hard, even with this help, because there's not enough units out there.
So to follow up on that, because I'm really trying to get at the question of availability and whether this bill made an impact at all on that, and maybe it's a wrong question to say, are there more units, because there may be so many other factors, but is there a greater percent of people with Section 8 vouchers able to find housing Do you, you know, is the time shortened at all for looking? Is the percent who are able to find housing before they have to return it? I think it's 3 months. You get the federal.
They can get up to 4 months, six months if they're disabled.
Okay. Are there fewer that are turning them back in, not having been able to find any?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not a measure that would indicate the success of the bill because it's the market. Mm-hmm. I think. Time will tell as the market changes. It's cyclical. It always is that we're going to have to watch this closely and measure it against what the market was a few years ago and look at what our rates were.
Too soon.
I think it's too soon to tell.
Okay. Representative Buehler.
Yeah. I don't like your answer with all due respect. I think we're not interested in the success of a bill. We're interested in the success of actually helping people. Mm-hmm. So I think you should be tracking what Chair Kenny Geyer outlined is how many of these are being returned, because I think that's an important metric of how the conditions are actually in these communities.
Oh, and I'm sorry if I didn't convey, we do track that. We know those numbers. They're worse now than they were 2 years ago because of the market. The market vacancy rate is about 3% in Multnomah County, 1% in certain areas, less than 0.5% in Bend. Mm-hmm. So this is a market program. If you have a voucher, you're competing with every other person that's not low income for the same unit. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's difficult for folks.
So let me try to ask this in another way. We might be trying to get the same thing. So it's still very tight market. Mm-hmm. Let's just throw out a number. Like before, you had a certain market, and maybe 80% went to non-Section 8 and 20% went to Section 8. Now you still have a tight market, and so the number of units may, I don't know what's happened to them, but has the percent going to Section 8 increased at all? Has it given them a competitive advantage at all because of the mitigation fund?
We haven't seen that yet at this point.
Okay.
I think we're still in the early education phase. It's not been a year till July 1st.
That's what I was starting to pick up from the report.
I think there's more overall units available through Section 8, of course. But again, it is cyclical, and it takes a while for us to see the market shift. Not all rental properties become available in just a single year.
Right.
It takes a while for us to churn through that.
Okay.
Also, and the Housing and Community Services groups are learning that to be competitive with the local market, particularly in a low vacancy rate process, they have to speed up their process and their review, and they're doing so, and they're making tremendous strides. No offense, you know, government isn't always the speediest, and when you're competing with people in the normal market, they turn in an application, they have money in hand, they're ready to go, and to wait for the turnaround from the government can sometimes, from a private market standpoint, be a bit burdensome. We go, gosh, we've got somebody here with money in hand, they're ready to move in today, versus a Section 8 tenant with that. Sure, they could have money in hand, and it's a guaranteed program, but it might take 7 days or 10 days or 14 days. It's time is money. And with the tight market conditions, I think that's why we're seeing some of the vouchers not being turned back, is not just because there aren't willing landlords out there to rent to them. Mm-hmm. It's just there are people that are not Section 8 participants that are ready to move in sooner than the government or the housing authorities are able to turn around. Mm-hmm. And they're working at that, the federal level, to ask for some leniency with HUD rules and stuff. But changing HUD isn't easy nor fast.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Buehler?
Yeah. So what can we do to solve our problem, which I assume the core problem here is trying to have more affordable housing for people? What can we do to solve this problem? What are the main drivers causing such a lack of affordable housing, not only in Bend, but in many cities in Oregon right now?
So I'll take a stab at that, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Buehler. Keep in mind that these are market rent housing units. Mm-hmm. These are not affordable housing units. These are units that rent at market rate levels. That's the beauty of the program. It's a federal subsidy helping a low-income family, but paying a private landlord what the private landlord could get on the private market, that three-way triangle that Jill showed you. So the supply issue there is not related to affordability so much as the affordable housing crisis. It's just the supply issue. And as Jim has been trying to say, he's been doing this 20 years.
26, yes.
26 years. His father and grandfather did it before him. It's cyclical. And so in our community, he and I are in Eugene, in Springfield, supply has actually been pretty good because Eugene's had a whole bunch of developers building student housing, flooding the market with student housing. That's not the case in Portland. Bend is a different situation, and I don't know that I can I don't know that anybody has a solution for why Bend hasn't had more market rate housing built. We struggled.
I can help with that.
Don't get him started.
Yeah.
I know, and I used to do.
I can take a guess at what he's
saying. I bet everyone in this community can answer that question.
I used to do land use planning for the state, so I could argue too. But I think that we've struggled getting development, even market rate development, outside of the Willamette Valley. For lots of reasons. And some of those reasons have to do with developers that are big enough, funding from private sector. I mean, these are units that should pay for themselves. And I know your argument has to do with land supply. There's supposed to be an adequate land supply. That's probably arguable with regard to Bend.
Mm-hmm. But the evidence speaks volumes, and it's just not Bend.
We should talk over a beer. So I'll stop there.
Chair Kenegaard, so I have a couple of questions maybe for several of you or a couple of staged questions here. According to the Housing Authority, and we've heard in your testimony that about 75% of these vouchers are successful or 100% in your case. According to the Oregonian, it's telling us that Linn County is about 62% successful, Benton County is about 53% successful, and with this bill coming into effect, it also levied up to $11,000 fine for landlords that didn't quite go through the process properly. So the question is, what is the difference in percentages of what we're seeing reported hearing committee versus what Housing Authority is telling us here? And does that, for the housing people, does that fine have some of the landlords looking closer at applications in other areas? Does that fine, the $11,000 fine, discourage some people from really being gung-ho about it is the question.
Can you talk about the Linn County? Mm-hmm.
So I can talk about success rates. I didn't see the article myself. Did you see it, Todd? So success rates are different than utilization rates. The housing authorities all across the state are utilizing their vouchers, but to do that, they have to issue more than they have. So if you put 100 vouchers in 100 families' hands, 75 of them are successful. Well, if you have 100 vouchers, you have to give 200 people vouchers to make sure that you're using all of them. So what you do is you work really hard up front and you overissue so that 100% get utilized. So success rate is different. It's the people that have them, that have the opportunity, that actually can use them. But the housing authorities work really hard and a lot of people fail, but they use all their vouchers. So that's why it's a little confusing.
And I can say also for the rural areas that Home Forward has a lot of programs and partnerships that are help people to become successful with the program. But in the rural areas, because of limited staff and lack of resources, the numbers are lower, and also lack of units. There's just a lot more units in general in Portland, even though the market is tight. But in the rural areas, there's just a severe lack of units in general, market units or affordable housing units. So I think that compounds those numbers and makes them lower success rates in the more rural areas.
Follow up. So thank you. Still didn't answer the penalty that could be imposed. How does that?
My job.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Hayden, I think what you're referring to is enforcement. Mm-hmm. Of fair housing violations. So keep in mind, this is not any different than discriminating on the basis of race or religion. the way the state statute works. In our state, that enforcement is done by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Somebody files a complaint. BOLI will investigate. They'll contact the person that the complaint's against, get a response, interview people, weigh it, and then they may process a claim through an administrative process, or it could go to court. And I think the $11,000 figure refers to a typical administrative fine for a finding that someone has violated the fair housing statutes of Oregon. So the way it would work, that's an incentive, from my point of view, it's an incentive for a landlord to comply with the law, to not refuse to rent to a Section 8 applicant. The landlords have done a remarkable job of educating their members, but there are still some landlords who are not going to follow the statute. A report has a statement from the Fair Housing Council of Oregon saying that it gets a lot of calls about this issue, and what the FHCO typically, I'm on the board of FHCO, typically will call the landlord involved and say, by the way, did you know you can't advertise this anymore? You can't refuse to accept an application from somebody just because they have a Section 8 voucher. You have to evaluate them. And some landlords will say, thank you very much, I didn't understand that. Some landlords will say, I don't care. So there will be some cases brought against those sorts of people. We haven't seen very many brought yet because we've been working on the education aspect of it. But clearly there are. I did a talk. Jim had a giant meeting of his group with, 200 people in the room. And at the end of the presentation, after quick question and answers, one landlord said, how do I get around this law? There must be a loophole. So there probably are some loopholes, although I'm not going to tell you. But the idea of the fine is to incur, we're hoping there won't be any administrative processes or fines, but I'm sure there will be. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it just seems like the $5,000 carrot is a little bit smaller than the $11,000 stick.
Well, that's the idea, a carrot for the landlord to comply with by having the deposit. Jim has talked about this is a really, where else can you in a private landlord market get a $5,000 security deposit? And then the stick is if you don't accept these applications and consider them, then we're going to punish you.
Originally, landlords had asked for $10,000.
You're getting closer.
A couple things. Well, one, just to follow up on that conversation, I mean, we only appropriated about $75,000, so that's 15 houses. That doesn't go very far. As a landlord, I'd be in the appropriation last year for the in 2013 for the housing choice. It was a $75,000 roughly request to the e-board. So if I went in and I had $5,000 against that fund, I mean, you're only going to get to fund 15 landlords who might have a dispute, and it didn't, you actually have to go to court and do the whole judgment process first, and there's no payment back to, the landlord for the attorney's fees to do that. I mean, I still don't think that there's an incentive for a landlord to want to take Section 8. I actually voted against the bill because of that in 2013, and not that I don't support, people having housing, but it has historically been a higher risk pool of renters. I've personally had a renter one time, not Section 8, but somebody who probably was on a waiting list, was on a waiting list for Section 8, tore my house apart. The mitigation fund would never have covered the damages that we'd incurred and had to go through our homeowners insurance to do, and that certainly drives up our costs. So I still think there's not quite the incentive that I've heard today, this is an incentive to rent. I don't personally see that as being incentive still, because $5,000, to Cedric Caden's point, is correct. It's just not a big enough carrot, if you will. But I do want to ask, so that was more common on your guys' conversation, but the question I actually had was, if people are turning the vouchers back in and they still have a housing need, then where are they going? I mean, if they're not using the voucher, are they finding affordable housing somewhere else that's just not taking the voucher, or are they, I guess
we don't track that, unfortunately.
Okay.
We don't. Right now we're in the process of doing a survey to understand why they were unsuccessful. And I wish we had the funding to track things like that. HUD gives us very minimal funding to run the program.
Follow up. So you said that the person, someone getting a voucher, that the average sort of income is around the $12,000 range. Mm-hmm. What's the average value of the voucher, and is it actually enough to apply to, real market rates? Historically, when we grew up on Section 8, it was never enough to cover the real market rate, and that was in the 80s.
There's still a big gap between what HUD will allow and what the real market is. HUD is about 3 years behind the real market. That's why a lot of the housing authorities in the state struggle more than Home Forward. We have some flexibility that they don't have, which allows us to really pay market. And we've actually done that in Multnomah County. We have 9 different payment standards or maximum amounts, depending on where the unit is to accommodate for the higher expensive neighborhoods. The rest of the state can't do that. So there are limits because of HUD regulations.
Do you think those limits are precluding someone from using the voucher?
Absolutely.
So I have this voucher. It's essentially kind of free money. I can't find a unit, or maybe I can find a unit, but that gap is still causing me to not use the voucher. That has to be one of the reasons why people aren't using it, is that they still have a dollar amount that they have to fulfill. So it's not just a lack of affordable housing. It's just that they're still not being able to cover the gap between voucher and real market rent.
They can afford real market rent in most neighborhoods, certainly not in all. So there's definitely some areas. Our rents are set. There's for a one bedroom in one neighborhood to another, there's $300 and $400 difference in what we'll allow for the same unit.
Okay. I think it's also important to note that just because somebody has a voucher doesn't mean they're going to be a good tenant or that we will rent to them. Mm-hmm. Through our normal screening process, we turn down applicants all the time, Section 8 and non-Section 8. So just because somebody's not able to fulfill a voucher, I don't think is necessarily an indication that there's not housing available for them. You have to look into their background as to why that housing was not available or made available to them from landlords.
Can I follow up on that question?
Yeah.
So, that's a good point. So let's say that somebody gets an FED or whatever on there. That's going to show up even if I have a voucher. Mm-hmm. Yes? No?
With proper screening, correct.
When you say with proper screening, what does that mean? If
a landlord does do an FED check through OGIN or through our credit screening process, they will find an FED. And if that FED, there was a judgment against the tenant, simply a filing of an FED is not something that we automatically disqualify somebody from. But if there's a judgment against them, monetary judgment in particular, then yes, we hold that against a tenant.
An individual landlord, though, could, if there is an FED, though, say, and they do a background check, see that, can discriminate at that point, or can choose to not rent if they see an FED.
We can discriminate against FEDs, that's a typically an FED is a judgment for possession of the property because the tenant is either failing to pay their portion of the rent or they've done some other major violation of the rental agreement that makes the landlord have to go to court to remove them.
And how big of a problem is that with your current batch of folks who have Section 8 vouchers?
The Housing Authority screens for eligibility for our program, and then landlords screen for tenant eligibility. So that would be a landlord question. It's a good question. It's not one that I have the answer to.
So it's not something we're tracking?
No.
Okay.
Is that him?
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. Help me out here. Might be a little bit slow, but you said that you have to give 200 vouchers to try and get a success rate based on 100 vouchers, and maybe that's 75% or 50% mm-hmm. depending on what. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that? You give the 200 vouchers just to utilize the funds, so
if you're in an area like Todd described where there's a 50% success rate in one of the rural communities, and you have 100 vouchers that you need to use so that you get your funding next year, and so you're housing people, you probably have to hand out 200 because only 50% of the folks will successfully find a unit. That's what it means.
And keep in mind that if they don't use them within a certain period of time, they have to give it back.
They have to give it back.
So the funding based on the next year is based on successful fillment?
Yes. Yes. And in addition to that, housing authorities are only paid for the work they do for those who are successful.
So I guess what you're saying is the success rate is about 25%.
Well, it depends. Every community is different.
What's your success rate?
Our success rate right now is about 75 in Multnomah County. 2 years ago, it was 90.
That's based off of 100% of the vouchers given.
Our utilization rate of our authorized vouchers across the state is close to 100% because we overissue. Does that make sense?
So we're being clear about utilization. So utilization means that if a housing authority gets 50 vouchers during the year, it will use all 50. But it may, if their success rate is 50%, then they may have to give them out to twice as many people as the vouchers they have over the year.
So you take two or three times the applicants knowing that you only give payout.
She's taken four for every three. Okay. What's your rate?
Ours is about 60.
So
10 for every six.
So you're not limited on the amount of applications you can approve. You're just limited on the actual funding of those ones that are successful.
Correct.
Yes, the number that are successful.
And that's what they have waiting lists.
So I have a follow-up to that. It's like selling airplane seats. What happens if you all of a sudden hit a higher success rate and they're holding a voucher and 70% instead of 50% are able to find housing?
Are you overcommitted? You are, but we do have attrition every month. So you just have to be very careful and watch it closely.
Yes. That's probably easier for a large housing authority such as Home Forward than it is for Todd's. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If he goes over by 20, he's in trouble.
Yeah,
but they could go over by 2,000 and be okay.
So you're just a little bit more generous in the beginning, and then you monitor it as you go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a balancing act.
Yes.
I wanted to respond, if I could, to Representative Parrish, not to argue about whether Section 8 tenancies are a good idea, but just a note that the three of us, were part of the rulemaking group. The bill requires rulemaking by the Housing and Community Services Department, and one of the things we defined is what damages are eligible to be compensated under that $5,000. It includes attorney fees. It includes court costs. It includes interest. It includes most everything you can think of. So we did address that. And I would also note that the cost of claims through March 31 is $31,000. Seven claims approved, $31,000 for 9 months.
Can I follow up?
Yep.
So is that, you testified earlier, though, your Section 8 landlords don't tend to track what's going on if they're mom and pop. So how much of that is because they're not tracking that fund's available, and what would that fund look like if they maybe were tracking that those funds were available? So if I'm just, you know, Julie landlord and I'm not tracking, I mean, look, the reality is most of our constituents aren't following along with what we're doing and watching what we're, you know, these hearings, right? So if they're out there and don't realize that this is even available, it's not like it was really super well publicized. I don't know how much education is happening with landlords when they come and say, I want to take Section 8, and how does this work, or if the landlord even has to do anything other than just simply accept the voucher, that they would even know that fund exists. So that would be, I guess, my pushback there is I've talked to some folks who didn't know that there was a fund exists. So it's somewhere there's a disconnect between people who are renting and, you know, and may or may not have a problem and realize that those funds are there.
It's possibly something we could address at the advisory committee. Housing authorities obviously are in contact with all the landlords that are current recipients of the Section 8 program, and not to be burdensome since money is tight, but obviously they have the landlords at the attention when they send them their rent check every single month, and some sort of notification or to the landlords that are currently recipients of Section 8 voucher holders, just notification that a fund is there could accomplish that goal of informing all current landlords that participate in the program that there is a mitigation fund that's available.
Do we know what the appropriation is for this year for this fund? Do we have a sense of that, or where is that coming from?
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, you mean in the next budget?
Yes, to backfill that. You've used it, drawn down $30,000-some.
Right.
What's the plan to backfill that?
I don't know. We haven't used up all the money that we've had. So we had in this biennium. So the next biennium, the governor's budget includes $307,000. It's in the report.
Okay.
And I can't remember whether the report has this year's biennium allocation. $475,000 this year. Okay, so we've spent $31,000 of the $475,000 for this biennium. Okay. That's a little bit more. That's a little simplification of an answer because the department took money from a different program to use for this, and there's some question about whether we should try to refund that program. But we haven't spent the money we've got so far. Now you may well be right that more landlords will make claims once they know about it. Although I would, part of our presentation was the amazing educational efforts the landlords and the housing authorities and the legal aid people have been doing, and with Meyer Memorial Trust help. And that $5,000 fund is like a neon sign going, $5,000, $5,000. It's a big part of the education effort. I'm sure there are lots of landlords that don't know about it and probably will see more. And we're knocking on doors hoping that the demand is not so great.
Thank you. Just one more question. A little visual aid here. So if you have 200 vouchers that you give out and you only expect 50 of those vouchers to be filled, what do you do internally to make sure that the last, and I'm making an assumption that, between 100 and 150 and 200, that maybe those are the last vouchers that you approve, but they might be to people that weren't quite as eligible down on the lower area. What do you do internally to assure that the neediest of the needy have an equal opportunity to get that one last house over somebody that is being giving a voucher just to try and get you there that might have a little more ability to go out there and, have the phone or the cell phone and the car and whatnot to go search for that. So how do you make that equitable for the poorest of the poor that may not have transportation or they might be wheelchair bound and they might not have the assets or resources available to them to go search?
Mm-hmm. We don't, unfortunately. At Home Forward, well, every housing authority has different preferences of who would get a voucher first. And some have none. It's just date and time of application. Some preference maybe domestic violence victims. Some preference veterans. Some preference homeless people. But housing authorities do not have funding to provide any kind of housing search assistance. We would count on partners to help us with that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, 30 years ago, I did have a program called Funded Housing Counselors that would help people use their vouchers. Mm-hmm. But that's gone. And right now, it really is survival of the fittest. Mm-hmm. So there's not a real way to say you're the neediest person with the voucher and we're going to help you the most.
Well, that kind of seems counterproductive to really helping the poorest of the poor.
Mm-hmm. You may have just thought about a new program.
Yeah, I'd like to see something internally there that before you give out that last between 100 and 150 vouchers just to meet that quota, that we go back and make sure that particularly the disabled people have an equal opportunity for mm-hmm. that last houses.
We have been awarded VASH vouchers for veterans that come with wraparound services provided by the VA Medical Center, everything from medical to housing search assistance to ongoing people to help them stay housed, housing stability people. The vouchers come to the housing authority, the service and housing search dollars come through the VA. So I think HUD is aware that it's a need. It's just them being willing to fund other populations beyond veterans.
And one of the things that we've talked about in the Housing Choice Advisory Committee is trying to do help the housing authorities do a better job of educating the voucher holders. They do a training when they first get their voucher to do a better job of educating them about what they have to do, what kind of information they have to give the landlord so they might be more successful. But it's still dog-eat-dog.
It is. I'll further that. In Link County, Eugene, Springfield area where I reside and John resides, we're working with our local housing authority. They're being fairly progressive in asking what more they can do on their end. They actually, it was surprising, they came to us as a private landlord and said, look, we've got this problem. Do you have any solutions? That doesn't always happen in government, that the government comes to us and asks. And so from a landlord's perspective, we said, look, educating the voucher holders, setting them up for success, teaching them, and we offered to volunteer, and we can talk about it at the statewide level, but having landlords come in and teach the tenants how they need to interact with the landlords, how to prepare themselves, basically coaching them that this is a job interview. We're turning over $150,000, $250,000 of our investment to them. We want to be assured in all communications with them that we're going to get that investment back. For most landlords in the state of Oregon, this is the single largest investment they've ever had and ever will have. So it's scary to turn over a significant amount of your income. I'm sure you can sympathize. And so having just instructing voucher holders how to dress, how to talk, how prepared to be when they show up to fill out an application, filling out sample applications, going through some of the potential barriers they might encounter, and coaching them on the best answers would help and will help, and hopefully will take place in Lane County soon.
Why aren't the landlords communicating directly with the housing authority and saying, I got 8 units available, who are your most needy 8 clients that we could offer that to first? Why don't we have that kind of communication?
There is, to a certain extent. Again, speaking for the Lane County Housing Authority, they have a binder that they keep in their lobby that landlords can email or fax what their current vacancies are or what their current vacancies will be coming up, and they will put them in that binder, and Section 8 voucher holders can come into the lobby and look and see what's coming up in the van in the near future.
Julie still got to get there. Okay, thank you.
Might be picking up a new state.
A larger carrot always helps for landlords.
I like the carrot.
Well, I would say that the average claim amount was $5,517. The average, not that was paid out, the average judgment amount.
Right.
And does that judgment amount, does that include legal fees and everything else?
Yes, ma'am. But keep in mind that most landlords seek these claims in small claims court where you're not allowed to have a lawyer. So that wouldn't be attorney fees.
But and it says judgment on the chart. It's judgment amount on top, and then there's interest, you know, other kinds of things, court fees, legal fees.
Correct.
So it does seem like if the average judgment amount is $5,517,
so I
not
think,
including some of those things, there's an argument to be made that it might.
Madam Chair, yeah. I think we're we need to work on our chart.
Okay.
And I would, legal fees, it's hard for me to imagine a lawyer charging $40. So my guess is that might be the filing fee.
For I that see. So claim. Legal fees might be part of the judgment.
Correct.
I see. That's, and the 9% is 9% a year?
And 9% a year, and that's
is
by
what
state
statute. The state pays to the landlord after the decision is made.
Right. The landlord, Madam Chair, the landlord has a year from the date of the judgment to file the claim with Housing and Community Services, and during that period of time, the landlord is entitled to 9% interest on the claim.
And is there any attempt to try to collect from the tenant?
Madam Chair, there are. The statute requires that, and the administrative rules address that, and there's a process.
Mm-hmm.
The landlords are very interested in making sure that tenants did feel some responsibility for it. And so I think the report notes that HCS has made attempts to collect from each of the tenants so far. There's a waiver process built in for those people who might have a good reason not to have paid. There's a requirement that they be offered repayment plans. So it's pretty thorough.
Okay.
So it seems like maybe one of the places there's a disconnect is I take my, Section 8 tenant to court and I successfully win. It would make sense that the judge says, oh, by the way, here's your form. Go down to, state of Oregon and get your money back or get it right. There's a disconnect there that if they're making those claims, are we actually seeing that communication happen at the point where they've been ordered a judgment? Maybe that's something for a different day. If I want to go to the back to the fund though, if one of the problems I heard was that 7-day window of, I come with cash and Chair Kennegaier comes with a Section 8 voucher that you're going to pick me first because I have you know, the ability to write that, issue those dollars right away. And if that fund is not being tapped, and even if it were being tapped at its capacity, it clearly isn't now, wouldn't it make more sense maybe for us to have a conversation about using some of those dollars? It would obviously take a subsequent piece of legislation, but using some of those dollars to actually help fill that gap, that cash gap of a security deposit, or, you know, doing a boost for security deposit rather than have those dollars go fallow, if over a period of the next few years, you know, we should come back and evaluate that to see if people really, if we're doing our job to move landlords that direction who've had some kind of harm from having a Section 8 tenant, but if we're really not using those dollars that way, to be able to come back and say that we might need to consider using them a different way. And I mean, I would be open to that conversation in a subsequent session, but I think we need some better data, and I think we need some better, you know, marketing to landlords to let them know that if they are experiencing that, or have the courts say, here's how you go and get some, seek some redress with the state for reimbursement for the, you know, judgment I just issued. Somewhere there's a disconnect there, but if we're not truly using the funds, mm-hmm. even after we've done everything we can to do to push landlords that direction, then maybe we should have a conversation else, what else to do with that fund and fill that gap.
If I could comment on that real quickly, I think that would, it's a tremendous idea, and that would equalize the playing field from a landlord's perspective, giving all things equal between two applicants, one had a voucher and one didn't, equal backgrounds and qualifications. The landlord, John's, I hate this, the landlord, in my opinion, would side in favor of the voucher holder, honestly, because of the mitigation fund, because it's business. And if one, I mean, typically landlords in general nowadays are not charging first and last. Most landlords just charge a single security deposit. There's a few holdouts that still charge the last month's rent, but you're certainly seeing more and more just charging a single security deposit that they can apply in any method and manner. So having the funds available, if it was a bridge of time wise, I think would be significant. That's been one of the landlord's largest concerns and one of the biggest barriers, because HUD does not allow the housing authorities to fund prior to them inspecting the property to make sure that it meets basic habitability requirements. And from a private landlord's perspective, if an application is approved, typically we say you must come up with funds within 24 hours to secure the property, else on we'll go to the next available applicant. If it's still available by the time you get your money together, sure, great, I'm happy to rent to you, but it's first come, first served. Mm-hmm. And 7 days was being generous. It can honestly take 10 to 14 days realistically, mm-hmm. by the time we turn, or the applicant turns in the application, and they schedule an inspection, the housing authority goes out and actually inspects the property and then approves it. It's 10 days is probably realistic, 10 to 12 days for that process. And when you rent properties out on a month-to-month basis, say $1,000 per month, 10 days is a significant portion of your income that you're asking a small private landlord to give up simply because they're a voucher holder. So,
can I add a couple things, please, in response to your comments? The education collaborative that was funded by the Meyer Memorial Trust, we have done extensive outreach to every registered landlord that has a business license, whether they're a member of any kind of rental association or not, inviting them to these education collaboratives. And all the invitations explained what it was about were really, really trying. And every housing authority that I have talked to is using that as a marketing tool because we're so desperate for units. So I can tell you that we've sent newsletters to all of our 3,000 landlords telling them about this because we're desperately wanting them to rent to more voucher holders. We're really trying to get the word out. And we are also, in Portland, we're offering that bit of funding on the front end for our VASH vouchers, for our homeless veteran vouchers, to see if it makes a difference. So we'll be testing that over the next year, and we can report back and let you know if it does make any difference in this tight market.
My last sort of comment is, you know, I mean, if when we debated the bill in 2013 and landlords said, hey, we'd like to see that fund be 10, and it got 5, and it didn't get used all the way, it would make sense to say, well, then let's have the 5 and use some of those additional funds to do that gap. Mm-hmm. And just a quick perusal of like a Craigslist, I mean, those security deposits anywhere from same month's rent, you know, maybe $900, sometimes a little over the first month's rent to cover that. But, you know, I'm not seeing anything higher than a $2,000 security deposit ask. So if, you know, you said, okay, there's $5,000 in the mitigation fund, but using those same funds, be able to help bridge that security deposit, which is a huge hurdle, and your voucher doesn't cover that. I mean, so no. I'm assuming, right, you have to actually pony up the cash, mm-hmm. even with the voucher. I mean, that's probably another reason for underutilization of the Section 8 voucher is, do you have a first month's rent in cash? If you need a Section 8 voucher, the odds are you don't have that in cash. So I would be interested in maybe seeing us and come back in 14 even and say, okay, here's this 5,000 or 16, sorry. I mean, it was an even year, just the wrong one. Come back in 16 and say, you know, so here's the fund for renters, but, you know, for landlords, but then let's use a piece of those dollars and pilot it even with 100 people and see if it makes an impact in actually having them use the vouchers. Mm-hmm. I think that's an appropriate use of that type of funds.
Mm-hmm. So a follow-up question to that, because I think Representative Parrish and Representative Hayden came up with some very innovative ideas that would really help extend this program. So thank you for creative thinking. Are you still meeting as a task force at all? Mm-hmm. And looking at, you know, ways to improve it, tracking it, looking at ways to improve it, and considering coming to us with legislation in 2016 and 2017?
The bill requires us to report to you every regular session.
Every regular session.
So I think though, that we would consider these ideas.
He said, this is great, and I think it might be great to have a report back in September in preparation for
that could be a good
the 20 and see if there's something, you know, ready for the 2016 session. We'll see. Maybe you think that's not enough time for you to prioritize what is needed. But, you know, Representative Hayden's idea would require more money if we were to help housing authorities across the state with a prioritization and an actual facilitation, whether you do it yourselves or contract out with community-based organizations. Whether that came out of general fund or whether it came out of the money that's been set aside for this at all, I guess, is a question. And then yours seems like very logically something that could come out of this particular money that's been set aside. And I think the third thing that just makes me think of, is it reasonable to increase it a little bit given that your average judgment amount was $5,517? That means if you set it at that, half the people would be, well, it's not a median, it's an average. It's an average, but
you could go 6 and then go 15, you know, 6,000, bump that to 6 and go 1,500 as a, you know, as a availability for security deposit, be it 7,500, which sort of splits the baby with the bathwater on what the landlords wanted in 2013.
Right.
So supports the landlords. I couldn't imagine that somebody from the landlord community would come out and say, please don't do that.
Yeah,
we don't want help with, you know, security deposits.
Yeah, so I think
tenants.
There's several ideas for, you know, for you all to chew on, and I'm sure you have a lot of other ones you would want to consider as well.
Wonderful. Thank you for your input.
Yeah. Great. Okay. No other questions?
Thank you.
And thank you so much. Close the information session on Section 8 housing. And again, so we have the work sessions scheduled for next Wednesday. Please hope this coming Wednesday. Please hold open Friday just in case anything happens and we need that last day. And Robin, we have a field trip scheduled for what date?
Madam Chair, the agenda is now posted. It's for June 10th at Farmworker Housing Development Corporation, and the exact details are it's arranged. It's just the exact meeting site will be posted on the agenda.
Okay, great. And we'll probably be emailing you all that. But hold that June 10th. I did this field trip with Representative Tomei a couple years ago, and it was really, really powerful. And I know Representative Gallegos will probably be particularly passionate about this. So with that, I adjourn the hearing.